How does the New Testament relate to the first coming of Jesus? Welcome to Probe. We continue our series on Probe, Gospel 1844, and Judgment. And our topic this week is the 70 weeks of Daniel 9. My conversation partners are again Dave Thomas and Paul Dibdahl from the School of Theology. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Let's come to that question. I want to focus now not so much on the Old Testament initially, but I would simply like to look at the New Testament. How did they relate to the questions of Messiah? What were their hopes, expectations, and how did that match up with what Jesus actually did? Can you give me a synopsis of your impression from reading the New Testament?
Well, I think in Judaism at that time, there certainly was a hope and a desire for some kind of deliverer, someone whom God would send that would bring restoration and relief to them mm-hmm. in their trouble. So there was certainly a hope of some kind of deliverer that mm-hmm. God would send.
Where does that come from the Old Testament? Are there specific passages that predict that with some forcefulness?
I think there are. I'm not sure if you have one or two particularly in mind.
Well, what I'm getting at here is a lot of the passages, and we may want to come back to this, but a lot of passages that are described as prophecy in Matthew, for example, really don't predict. They more illustrate. Mm-hmm. Out of Egypt have I called my son. Okay. It's perhaps one of the better known ones. You go back to Hosea, it applies to Israel. What I see happening in the New Testament is a lot of taking things they already know to be true and finding phrases that apply. But if you go back to the Old Testament, you really wouldn't guess that they were predicting.
But isn't that the way life goes? That as time goes by, our understanding of the plan of God increases mm-hmm. and therefore becomes more precise, and we're able to look back and pull out from a past context something that applies to. That's what Peter did on the day of Pentecost. You know, he didn't quote Joel's prophecy exactly. He modified it because he saw, I think, under unction of the Spirit, that what was happening in his day was a fulfillment. I imagine he thought it was the beginning of the final fulfillment of Joel's prophecy. It turned out mm-hmm. not to be the final fulfillment. But that the clarity that came with the passage of time and circumstance, I think, is what allowed him to do that. So while I would agree with you that people do, that the New Testament does it with the Old Testament, that's not a detraction. And nobody should take that as a detraction of the connection between the Old Testament and Messiah.
To be sure. But what that did for me, at one point in my experience, when all of a sudden I begin comparing how Matthew used the Bible, how I used the Old Testament, that startled me and troubled me because I'd been taught that you have to read in context.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as I discovered, Jewish Midrash, which tends to read later truths back into earlier passages, all of a sudden that began to make sense. Then I looked more at our own day and discovered how many times we do that today. Still, we take phrases, we reapply it. And we've had one good example of this already in Daniel 7, one coming with the clouds of heaven. Now, if you look at the way the New Testament interprets that, it is a heaven-to-earth movement. If you look in Daniel 7, it is horizontal. One comes to the Ancient of Days. I remember one of my professors who was no longer a believer. He was a believer at one point. Pointing that out with only moderate glee. Well, maybe glee is too strong. But as if this were a, would somehow undermine my faith. Now, I didn't tell him within my Adventist community that that fits perfectly with the pre-Advent judgment. But to see that dynamism of Scripture, I think, is very important. But still, that doesn't answer my question initially. Where in the Old Testament do you get the clear passages that do predict someone is to come. And that's when I went back, and in my little book, Who's Afraid of the Old Testament God, I have a chapter there on the Messiah where I basically lay out what I discovered. And Sigmund Moravec's book, Mid-Century, was a good illustration, and he deliberately gave it a very broad title because he wanted to include all those bits and pieces that pointed forward to someone who was to come. Not just the Messiah, which is the anointed one, mm-hmm. that's royal, but the prophet, mm-hmm. the Son of Man, mm-hmm. Shiloh, star, mm-hmm. all of those. And my guess is that if you look at Luke 24:44, where Jesus quoted from the Old Testament, all those passages, from the law, the prophets, mm-hmm. and from the Psalms concerning mm-hmm. me, you'll find those passages there, that someone is coming. And that, I think, explains, Paul, why you said everybody, but everybody was expecting a Messiah.
And it's also interesting that the ministry of John the Baptist would never have caught fire as it did if it had not been for that expectation.
That's right. See? Yeah. The only question was then, what kind of Messiah?
Yeah, and that's the ironic thing as well. They are all anxious for this kind of, for the mm-hmm. Messiah to come. When Jesus does appear, their expectations are not met, and they miss the one who was to come.
And in fact, that quote in Luke is really quite intriguing because it's past tense. We had hoped
that he was the one. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And see, this to me, if I can bend this in a little bit more practical way for a moment. This discussion is one that I think should produce a lot of caution in those of us who live today. If you think you have the issues as they pertain to the coming of Jesus or to any future predictions of Scripture completely ironed out so as to have it all in the bag, so to speak, remember that there are people before you who thought the same thing who ended up completely wrong. And so I think we as people should always be petitioners. And humble, asking God to lead and to guide and to adjust our understanding of reality as times warrant. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think even so, it's sobering to consider that those who had their view of the future most clearly defined in their own minds were the ones who seemed most closed to the surprising ways that God yeah. chose to mm-hmm. To act in history.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, God comes at us sometimes from odd and obtuse mm-hmm. angles.
As it is.
In fact, if you forgive me one more thing, I was thinking of a passage in Luke, I think it's Luke 3, where it gives a recitation of all the big boys of the time, you know, the Caesar and the governors and the high priests, and then it says, but the word of the Lord came to John the Baptist in the wilderness. Whoa, that's quite a text of scripture to me.
Yeah.
You know, everybody was expecting that somewhere through this line they'd have everything figured out, and God went outside.
Mm-hmm. And what I think it's so important for us to remember that if we go back to that New Testament, the church was born in a stable, very humble beginnings.
Yeah.
And that's why I think in our day, you know, sometimes Adventists wince at our origins because it was born in a terrible mistake, so to speak. I believe the Lord used that experience to, in a sense, shake the people down to a solid foundation.
Yeah, it's probably the same reason why Jesus picked a bunch of unlearned fishermen for his yeah. disciples, because mm-hmm. they were teachable. And sometimes when our skies fall in, we suddenly want to know.
That's right.
Yeah. What God is doing anyway.
You can go to the Old Testament and you can find the suffering servant. But nobody wanted to hear that before mm-hmm. Jesus' resurrection. Nobody. Yeah. I mean,
you know,
nobody.
We prize it today, though. I mean, we yeah. like to recite that only in retrospect, though, yeah. not in prospect.
Yeah. And I think that that's a very powerful reminder for us that we need to be willing to be the suffering servant, not to ride into the city in the royal chariots. Mm. Now, if we then look at the nature of religious experience that oftentimes involves disappointment, maybe this would then help us to treat the 70 weeks rather more gently. Let's take off all the dates, and there's a good reason for doing that, because the dates that Adventists have used were not really developed until the era of the Reformation. And if you try to nail down a particular date and then place all of your weight on that date, that can be really problematic. In the end, I don't think it needs to make a lot of difference. In my family, for example, my father was born in Buckley, Washington. But the records in Buckley, Washington are not clear whether he was born in 1914 or 1915. That doesn't call into existence, call into question my father's existence. And so likewise, after these events come down, the message of Daniel 9 is a powerful one, but it was applied to Christ much later. It wasn't seemingly, the New Testament never uses that as an argument for Jesus coming. So you don't get these people with their calculators and their slide rules and, now we got.
Although I do wonder how the priests knew that the location and the approximate time when the wise men came, they told them.
That's true, but there's no indication where they found that out.
I know, and that's why I'm saying that's one aspect that does lead me to wonder if they didn't know more about Daniel than we give them than we sometimes think.
That could very well be. The first application of the 70 weeks, so ties it up with the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70.
Yeah.
So it's a mystery, but I don't think that we need to know those kinds of things in order to be able to make the application.
Well, in other words, you're saying that the application is grander than the dates we attach to it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the Lord is always stuck with human calculations, and he will use those. Mm-hmm. But the point is always larger and greater and more powerful than that.
Yeah.
Is the suffering servant still a dominant motif for the Christian church? Or are we now stuck with large buildings?
It depends on where you are and where you live. And I think that motif is alive and well, so to speak, in parts of the world where Christians face suffering and persecution and where they are misunderstood and mistreated. So I don't think by any stretch that has been lost to Christianity. It is not. It has been lost perhaps to portions of Christianity, but certainly not to all.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm intrigued also by the 70 weeks because they seem to be a probationary period. I don't know if you guys have any comments on that. But I mean, it's 70
weeks. For the people of Israel?
Yeah, it's determined upon Daniel's people.
Mm-hmm.
In the 70 weeks, if you look at the interpretation of prophecy on a broad scale between different religious groups, it's quite problematic. But I guess we don't have time to talk about that today.
We may have to come back to that next time or next year and solve the problem again. The application, however, of the 70 weeks, I think, does generate some very important questions for us, ones that we'll want to continue to explore. Next week, we're going to be talking about, the title is simply 1844 Made Simple. I hope we don't make it too simple, but on the other hand, I want to see it is very simple in some ways. So we'll pick up those pieces next week. Thank you, Dave and Paul, for your assistance. And thank you to our program engineer, Susan Michael, and for all of you for listening in for Probe. I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Probe, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla College and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194 or email us at probe@wwc.edu. Thanks for listening. We'll be here next week at this time with Probe.